Hello, welcome to Alden Village. Today is July 29th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Straight into Gay America, presented by Lars Claussen.
For the recorder, but thanks for being here. I heard dinner was really good. There it is. I went over and listened to Paul Olson reading from the Brothers K. So I'll trade dinner for peanut butter tonight, I guess. So, which was really good. So my name is Lars Claussen, and I'm really thankful we can have this hour here together. Got a slideshow to show you. I'm only back 9 days from a 5-week, 1,000-mile unicycle ride that went from Vermont and then down to Washington, D.C. and Maryland. And I went with a question. What is everyday LGBT life, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender life like in America today? You know, I wanted to get a slice of that picture, because it's such a polarized piece of our country today, both religiously and politically. For those of you that are members of the ELCA or even many of the other denominations, you know that this is, this is a multi-million dollar and very big political issue in the churches. I'm a Lutheran pastor, that's my background. I've lived here the past 2 years with my wife Ann and our two kids. She and I helped at the school. We were teacher aides to the teachers there, and we are finishing up on Sunday and moving to Wenatchee. So 2 years here. So my credentials for doing this ride are that 3 years ago I unicycled through all 50 states, and I wrote this book about it. And I guess just, I'll pass it around, it's in the bookstore. This one had a focus on getting through 50 states, so that's a big piece of it if you want to hear about unicycling, but also about Native America. Was one of the things that I was really going through as many native lands as possible. Ann and I lived in Nome, Alaska. I was a pastor at the Seward Peninsula Lutheran Ministry up there. Some of you might know that if you're Lutherans. It's a 110-year-old ministry up there at this point. And so we lived there and gained a real appreciation for a different culture, a hunting-gathering way of doing life. So I'll pass this around. There's some pictures in that as well. We'll have a slideshow in a few minutes. And I'm going to start with a poem by Jim Bodine, because he was just here, and he spent some time in El Salvador, and he said, you know, for the rest of my life, he just retired, he says, I want to spend my life hearing stories. He said, you and I are doing the same thing. And I think all of us, in whatever way we dare to listen to stories, are doing the same things. So read this poem, and the other piece is I'm just back 9 days from listening. And that's what I've been doing, is hearing stories. So I'm not really in the telling mode at this point. So a lot of this will just be question and answer. But I will tell you, let me tell you the conclusion before I read this poem. And that is that some of you know Soul Force. I was there, and the young intern, this is in Lynchburg, Virginia, the young intern who was there was interviewed for this documentary that they're making about my ride, and was asked about how important are allies. Okay, and allies are the people who are known as supporting equal rights and full respect and dignity for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. And he told a story about Bishop Gene Robinson. You know, perhaps, that Bishop Gene Robinson was the openly gay, partnered Episcopal priest who was chosen by the people of New Hampshire to be their bishop. And so he asked this question, what does it take to make a good ally, in a speech that he was given? And it was just kind of this question, and he didn't follow it up, he didn't answer it. But afterwards, a person came up and said, you know, I know what it takes to make a good ally. So here's the conclusion of my talk, of what this person said to Gene Robinson was, what it takes to make a good ally is to listen. To really listen, and then to believe what you hear. To listen to those who are on the margins, who are on the outside, and then to believe what we hear. It's pretty simple, but it's pretty hard. To really listen, and then to believe. And then if we're in a leadership position, it has something to do with acting as well. So here's that poem. My eyes are going bad, so I'll use the light. It's called In the Marie Sandoz Crazy Horse Camp. It's on the back cover of this book that I just got at the auction yesterday. We keep the strong black medicine, coffee. We say no to whiskey. This is a Native American poem. We shed the fat of the soldier food. We say no to things that divide us. Someone will say something of the world behind this one. We accept the fact that we are a broken people. We have left people behind to come here. Women go with the men they choose, openly, untroubled, as is their right. The hearts of our women are not dust. We are not whipped. We are shirt wearers. We are big-hearted. The shirts show the solid world of our new life. We will resist the reservation. We will not go in. We are defenseless, but we are strategists. We will use the earth for cover. We are warriors. We have discipline. Our enemies will not hurt us. We are vigilant before our own people. From defeat, we have achieved a new fierceness, a new kind of recklessness. There can be no anger in the heart. You learn how to go off by yourself. You learn that you belong to others. We have been shadow marked. Breathing together, we cross through language, and no one can say what our work will be. That's from Impulse to Love by Jim Bodine. He's been up here a couple times this past winter, and for some of us who got to meet with him, he's really been a big influence in us. And Eric is going to be featured in an upcoming book. So I'll start with a riddle, and then what I'm going to do is tell a couple stories, and then I'll show these slides, which I haven't labeled, okay? I just wanted you to see images of places and of people and things like that, and we can ask questions at the end. I'll tell a few stories, but I'd much rather be having this be a time of sharing where we're at, and I'll do a part of that from this journey. But the riddle is this. I started in Vermont. I started in Vermont intentionally because that's the first state that adopted civil unions. And what happened was the Supreme Court looked at a case and said, you know, in Vermont, we have a rule that no one can have a right that is not granted to everybody. And so this is not right. This isn't fair. And instead of the court saying, this is what you have to do, which is what happened in Massachusetts, the court said you have to have marriage for lesbian and gay and heterosexual people. Instead of doing that, 5 years ago in 2000, the court gave it to the legislature and said, you come up with a solution. And the stories, if you go to Vermont, of that time are still so fresh in people's minds. And that state is so small that most people know their legislators. And what happened in the winter and the spring as they were discussing this, it would be on the radio. And I heard from person after person who said, I knew I had to be there. And they would hop in their car and they would drive to Montpelier, to the state house, and they would go in and listen to these things. It was this huge event which just barely passed 50-50, and I got to talk to a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter down in Rutland who wrote a book after this called The Civil Wars. But he wrote editorial pieces for 4 months while this was happening. And he followed particularly those legislatures who had a change of heart, who had said this isn't a big deal, to the point where they actually heard so much hatred that they said, we have to do something. And there were legislators who said, I know that when I vote for this, it will mean the end of my service as a legislator. There was a policeman who had been a policeman who lost his job. There was a dairy farmer who lost his job. There are others. I don't know all these stories. But what happened as a result of that was that in Vermont now, there's a piece of paper called a marriage. And on it is all the language of a marriage certificate. And there's a piece of paper called a civil union certificate. And on it is the exact same language. The only difference is whether it says marriage license or civil union license on the top of it. And what people in Vermont can now have are state benefits. They still can't have the over 1,000 federal benefits that apply to heterosexual married couples. But at least in that state, they have the state benefits. So here's the riddle. The second night of my trip, I stayed with two women who had been able to enjoy the benefit of one of those civil unions. The next night, I stayed with two women who had to get married. What happened? No, it's happened in Vermont. These two women were not allowed to have a civil union. They couldn't get one. They actually wanted one. They said, you know, this isn't right that we have to get married. That you know, our other people that we know get a civil union and we have to get married. What happened?
They're pastors.
They're what?
Pastors.
Pastors? No, that's not going to help you.
Our organization doesn't do too much for me.
Was that the story that involved children?
No. There are children. They have four children. But that's not what's going on.
Defying women.
Pardon?
Defying women. We are transgender.
Yeah. So, the first night, it was these two women who got married. Had a civil union. The next night, they had to get a marriage. Because Danielle, who had been Daniel and was born in Pennsylvania, could only change one thing at a time on her birth certificate. So she changed her name. But gender still says male on her birth certificate. And so, because you have a male birth certificate and a female birth certificate, they had a marriage. They weren't allowed to have a civil union. I tell you that little riddle, that little story, because I think one of the things that's very interesting to me is how we come at these situations. Do we come at these situations saying, you know, there has to be a rule to cover everything? And if there's not a rule to cover everything, we've got to build a rule to cover everything. That is one way to do things. And sort of big language, it's sort of this ontological view of life. That is, there is a certain framework that exists independent of all of us, and what our job is to learn what that framework is and then to adjust our lives to that framework. The opposite way, or the other end of this spectrum, is to say, you know, I heard a story about these two women who had a civil union, and then the next day I went and heard the story about these two women who had to get married. But what does it mean to hear those stories? And to sit there with those two women, Danielle and Sarah, and their four children, three of them born to Sarah, and one adopted in that family. And look at that family, and we talked about GLBT stuff for a long, long time, because that's what this ride was about. But then the next morning, actually stayed there two nights, we finally got to talking about Danielle, who is like a technical drafter at her work. And it's an energy, alternative energy place, and my background is engineering. And we got to talk about that very interesting stuff and trying to buy a French fry burning car, you know, these biodiesel cars. How interesting that was, that we could just talk about that as Danielle and me as people, right? But do you know that Danielle will not go to a doctor? She has a lot of medical issues. But she used to just get up and go to the doctor when she was sick. She has to use a cane. But she won't go to the doctor now. She waits a whole week until she's almost deathly ill. Because do you know what's happened every single time except once when she went to the doctor? Her partner, Sarah, would come along. And the doctor would talk to who? Who's the patient?
Danielle.
And the doctor could not talk to Danielle. You feel that? That's the idea, that there is a framework of what is right and what is wrong. And if you fit inside that framework, well, then I can talk to you because I can be uncomfortable and be comfortable. And if you're outside of that framework, then I can't relate to you as a human being. All right? I got into Virginia and I figured out what it means to be gay in America. And it's overspeaking to say that, because I don't really know. This was a choice I had, to be on that road or not. Another interesting thing before I get to Virginia Roads is how many stories I heard from people who said, I knew from a very young age that I was different. and people who are my age and older only had that word different to describe who they were. The words gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender, if you're my age or older, were not common terms in our growing up, were they? And I heard stories over and over again of people saying, well, I knew that I was different. And the most dramatic one was this friend that I got to be a friend in New York City. He grew up in Long Island. He's exactly my age. And he says, I knew from the age of two that I'm gay. From the age of two, he says, I wish I could say it from birth, but two was the first time I knew. He had older brothers and sisters, and he said, my sister would bring home these girls. One of them grew up to be this famous model. He said, I couldn't care less. But when my brother brought home friends, he said, I was so interested in them. He knew from this very young age. When did he get language for it? Remember when, was it Mayor Moscone and Alderman, or Assemblyman Milk, who were killed in San Francisco, murdered? And that got on the news all over, and that was the first time that he saw two men hugging each other or two women hugging each other. The first time that he heard the word gay. The first time that he knew he was not all alone in this world. He had this sense, he said, I knew there must be other people like me. But you see, we didn't have any language. And he grew up in that kind of complete isolation. Virginia Rhodes, all the way from Vermont through Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, I never once felt in danger on the roads. That includes riding through Manhattan, through Times Square, in the rain, during rush hour. I got into Virginia, and four lanes of traffic from Fredericksburg, Maryland, turned into a two-lane road with no shoulder. 18 inches at the most, often 4 inches, sometimes two. Rush hour of people going down to Leesburg, Virginia to their work. Semis going by. If a semi came this way and one that way and they had to meet and I was there, there wasn't room for all of us. I heard these squealing brakes and I lasted 10 minutes on that road and I got off it shaking. And I turned around and looked back and realized there's no room to even hitchhike here. I couldn't even hitchhike. I had to walk half a mile back to a gas station. And that all that time before I had space. And to make the comparison, I've had the space, all of that trip, to say openly how much I long to get back to my wife and to my children on the 5-week trip. And how easy it's been for me to talk my whole life about my partner and my family. And how, at least from the stories that I've heard, when you're gay, that space does not exist. I had somebody write, don't make the ELCA sound any worse than it is. One time when I had this little thing on my email, and it was a beloved pastor who wrote it back. He says, I know many gay and lesbian pastors who are serving in the Sacramento area who are gay and lesbian and they're doing just fine. Why? They are there by the grace of individuals who have made a decision to accept them. But what if 20 people in the church raise a big hullabaloo? Or what if there's a big political issue and all of a sudden the bishop has to make a personal decision? It's like, you see, there are no shoulders built in to ride safely in this country yet at this time. And that includes Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut that have civil union and marriage laws, because it's not a federal benefit yet. I've got pictures here. If you just hit the space bar ASAP, they'll show, and then we can visit, and we can talk. While they're showing, you can look at them. There's the details, 8 states, 5 weeks, 1,024 miles, and no flatirons. Congratulations. And then after this, it'll be pictures. So what is it? No sound, just pictures. Go ahead, look at them, and I'll just let it run. It takes about 15 minutes. We'll probably run it through twice, so you can enjoy it. What is it that you'd like to talk about this evening? We can just look at pictures.
Nice picture.
Vermont.
Yeah.
Your place.
David Stonecipher.
Met David here in 1998.
Was there a day you felt a paradigm shift in yourself?
That was some years before this ride, and I'd say it was a day when I went. The day that I kind of felt a shift was a day that I was at a conference, and I'd say I've been an ally or an advocate for about 15, 17 years now. But somewhere around 5 years ago, let's just watch the pictures. We'll talk after the pictures.
Can you turn his lights off?
Maybe.
Over there.
Over here?
Uh-huh.
There.
Tell us a little about the children.
That's Danielle and Sarah right there on the left. This is the video person, Jen, and that's kids in the family. On the right is the Vermont advocate for LGBT issues in the legislature. She's the editor of Out in the Mountains, the Vermont LGBT paper. That's Moose Meadow Lodge, and these two men, they run that. And he's done probably 150 civil unions. And the AP picked up the article real early in the ride. It's not quite Holden bread, but they were doing pretty good. Stereotypical church musician, gay man.
Where are you now?
We're still in Vermont. This is in Rutland. I spent a couple hours with these people, and they were incredibly wise.
She always sits out.
Yeah.
She's a character. You talk to her.
This is Smith College. See how tiny that sign is? That's the only advertisement for this gay bar. And the guy on the left, he's sort of the minister of the place. He's the bartender. That's the other documentarian. Tan takes that suit every place she goes and gets a picture. It's Hartford, Connecticut. This is my personal best ever for packing light. This was my only night of camping out. I bought that sheet at a Goodwill store. That's, the ferry goes from New London over to Orient on Long Island. Got to stay with these people. I just stopped and knocked. Became open and affirming just a couple months before I was there. Brooklyn Bridge. This is Clay, whose house I stayed at for, I think, 4 nights in Manhattan. He said, I'm so lucky here. He has this little studio. He just barely has space to live in it. That's the biggest area of walking in the whole apartment there. He says, I only pay $900 a month here. Yeah. So this is at the Pride Parade, which is the biggest one in the country, and as you saw, it started after Stonewall. And I think one of the significant things is that of all the, well, of course the dykes on bikes are significant, but but on the over 100,000 people that were there, we saw only four small groups of protesters, totaling 24 people. I mean, you know Barbara Lundblad.
I think I got lots of TV coverage, though.
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing, is how much coverage 24 people can get.
Get a decal and do a cycle.
No, the boot project.
This is Philadelphia. Notice that Grace United Methodist Church. MCC is Metropolitan Community Church, and was started by Troy Carey as a specific ministry to GLBT people, and I just happened to run across that. This is my favorite sign of the church. That's the actual pliers that she's using to get that off with. The pot lid got stuck on there, and Sarah's transgender. She still works for the Public Works Commission, so she had all the tools to get that off. Left. See the big shoulders in Virginia. Mm-hmm.
This is the road with no shoulder, right?
The new Native American Museum. It hasn't even been opened a whole year yet. Those are the names of all of the different tribes. Bishop Medardo Gomez from El Salvador just happened to get to have bagels with him. The guy that fixed my seat when the well broke. Some of you know them, Ben and Megan. They're living in D.C. now. Lauren Halverson stopped in Minneapolis on the way back a couple hours, and Ruth. So that's a little bit of a trip that I took, so I'm curious. I guess I should have figured it's hard to talk and look at the same time. Every night I tried to stay with somebody who had a story to tell and never disappointed. There were times when I'd be out traveling and not know where I was going to stay that night or what was going to come up next, and I had these great experiences, and then I thought, well, maybe this is it. You know, maybe nothing else is going to come along. And it just kept coming along and coming along until the very last day of the trip. I'm a real fan now of traveling in search of not really an answer, but traveling to follow a question. And 3 years ago, I did over 9,000 miles to get through all 50 states, and every day we had this place to get the following day. And this one, it was like, well, wherever the story went, that's where I tried to go. And the really wonderful thing to me is how willing people are to offer hospitality and to share kindness and to tell a story, especially when we're vulnerable. And just, you know, unicycling on the highway looks vulnerable. So people were incredibly generous on this trip. And in New York City, I stayed with this guy, Clay. He's the one I told you that said he knew when he was 2 years old that he was gay. And you know, some of us, the conversation is, well, we should provide equal rights, because who would choose to be gay or lesbian, bisexual, transgender if we had the choice? You know, all the things that you have to go through, like going along the side of that road. And Clay said to me, you know, if I had to do it over again, I'd want to be gay. He said, I've had such a good life. I've met so many wonderful people. I would want to be gay again. He said, I'd like to be heterosexual. I said, I'm curious. I'd like to try it. But only because he's curious. It's not because he was unhappy with his life. Clay's even been living with HIV for the last 14 years. That kind of saying, you know, this way of living, he could say, this is who I am. And really, to be able to know who we are, and to be thankful for who we are, and to be able to express living who we are, in kindness, caring, and compassion. I mean, what a wonderful thing for any of us, any human being, to be able to say what Clay is able to say. You know, I asked a lot of people, what do you think about equal rights, gay rights? I would ask this during the day as I rode along. And I never pushed myself on people, but people pushed themselves on me. You know, where are you going? What are you riding that thing for? All those kinds of things. And then if they asked what I was doing, I would tell them, well, I'm doing this ride for 5 weeks to find out what life is like in gay America. What do you think about equal rights? It was an interesting thing. Because the vast majority of people said, sure, everybody should have equal rights. That was the vast majority. That something in us has gotten through about sort of our founding principles of liberty and justice for all. There's a long stretch between saying those things and actually stepping out for other people. Go to the Native American Museum or go on the ride I took 3 years ago and get into this genocide that we lived out as a country in our history. You realize the pain there is between that statement of equal rights and the actuality of equal rights. But I found it very positive that the vast majority of us at least are saying we should all have equal rights. And of those who didn't automatically say it, you know, as some people haven't thought about this, I would tell them about those two people you saw at that nice lodge, the Moose Meadow Lodge, back in the beginning of that thing, Gary and, I'll say his name in a minute. Anyway, I would tell him about these two people and how I got to visit with them and how now because they have their civil union, when one of them's sick in the hospital, there's no question that the other can go and visit. That now, you know, they can be listed as the dependent person on the forms. They can be listed, you know, as the partner. And there's no question now. They can pass on their inheritance. I know cases, I heard cases where, you know, one of the partners would get sick and the other partner would then have to go through all this legal commotion. Imagine, right? Some of you know that, when a family member's gotten sick, how much energy it takes just to be with that person and deal with the rest of the family. Add on to that a legal challenge by, you know, this person's parents of whether or not you can even be there and say anything. Have to go through this whole legal process. Well, now, these two guys up there, they have that. And when I tell that story briefly and ask people should they have those rights, everybody except one person on the trip said, yeah, they should have those rights. I think one of the things that I'm able to do from this ride is to be able to report that. To be able to report that that's what I heard in our land. That we at least are saying that people should have equal rights. I know in our Lutheran church, in the last 5 years, what we've been very careful to do is try to give 50% of the time to the people who believe that we should have the full equal rights of ordination and blessing of same-sex unions within the Lutheran Church, and 50% of the time to those who think that that's not the way to go. That we want to do this fairness of time. But I really question, based on my ride, when I ask people, should equal rights be a part of every person's life? I don't hear that as a 50-50 thing, as a narrow debate. I hear it as an overwhelming affirmation of equal rights, or just a basic human dignity that this country believes in. So It's pretty interesting, those 24 people at the New York City Pride Parade and what percentage of the press that they will get to make the story. But I think that's an important piece of data. That one person who didn't say, oh, they should have rights, in a way it was even more discouraging because he started out and said, I'm a Christian, of course I'm opposed to this. And that wasn't really the discouraging thing because I heard that often. The discouraging thing was, he said, as he sat there with his daughter eating breakfast in this restaurant, I really couldn't care less. I really couldn't care less. And I didn't know whether to wish him a heterosexual daughter so she wouldn't have to even mess with this question, or a gay daughter, so that he would have to confront and care. But even more, to start by saying, I'm a Christian, and then to close by saying, I couldn't care less. That's the one that really was hard for me to hear. But that was one person out of all the people that I met. Lots of people believe that Christianity says that homosexuality is wrong. And for those of us that are doing theological work, we have a lot of work to do in that regard. But we have a lot of work to do in that regard. There are many, many people who have just left the Christian faith. Many, many gay people, lesbian people, bisexual, transgender people who have strong beliefs, strong faith, and either are very ambivalent about going back to church or have decided completely that they're never going back. And it's not necessarily because they've done the theological work to be able to understand that our Christian faith can celebrate the love of lesbian, gay, and bisexual and transgender people. It's not necessarily because they've done that work to understand that. Because that work, it's not common enough knowledge. But it's just like, you know, there's no respect here for my life, and there's no space here for my life. And I choose to try to find a place where I can have a little bit more shoulder, a little bit more margin in the road to make my life. I don't know, I've been a pastor for quite a while now, and I'm just not getting this one. I'm just not getting. That we can't hear these stories. I'm just not getting that there's a question this August about whether or not we're going to honor the stories that we've heard and believe the stories that we've heard. Yes?
How did you plan the route of your ride?
I didn't. Oh. I bought a ticket to Burlington, Vermont because David Stone, actually I didn't even know David Stone started to live there because I wanted to pedal into Montpelier, because that's the capital. And I wanted to get that story. You know, what is it about this state that chose to be the first state to have civil unions in this country in the year 2000? And now when you go there, it's like, duh, that's what we do. You hear that from all kinds of people. There are pockets of people who disagree with us, but that's far and away the majority. And it's like, yes, that's who we are. I wanted to go there and get that story. I had to pick a place to leave from, so I chose Baltimore. The ticket agent got that for me. And if I hadn't ended up there, I would have taken the train there. Actually, I took the train from Washington, D.C. up there to close it out. And otherwise, it was the other place that I chose was New York City. And Clay wrote to me and said, come on over. I wanted to go to the Stonewall Bar because that's where there are other places that did some early things, but that's one of the places where this movement for civil rights has a core starting place. And it just turned out that weekend was the Pride Parade. And so I signed up and actually got a spot. It wasn't exactly a float, but close to it. Yes.
How'd things go at Fall Church?
You know, it was a nice service. Made a crack about the American Communist Lawyers Union. and made his pitch that unless you believe in Jesus, you are nothing. But otherwise, very nice service. I mean, nice music. He said some funny jokes. I don't know if you saw how large he is, but he made a couple nice jokes. There was this guy in the aisle who'd been an usher for 50 years, and it was his birthday, and they were congratulating. He said, oh, his wife says he eats like a bird. He said, my wife says I eat like a bird, too, like a vulture, you know? I mean, he's a funny guy. Students at Liberty College, Liberty University, love him. He's very, very personable and friendly. I mean, he had, you know, in a big old church like that, that has a national broadcast, he has prayers for individuals, and he's been visiting individuals during the week. It's kind of an amazing thing. And then you go home and you read on the website this diatribe that's there about gay and lesbian people, people that are dealing with abortion, you know, and this kind of whole fear and just, you know, taking over the country. So it's this very interesting thing. So I'll say something now that I want to ask you, what is the difference between that and our church, if you're Lutheran, ELCA? What is the difference?
That one's broadcasted.
There's churches you can broadcast in.
Well, I don't know how to say it, the unequal rights is broadcasted.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only it's talked about as much.
I mean, I think this is a question worth thinking about. And the way I think about it is quality and quantity. You go to Jerry Falwell's church and you're going to get a lot more quantity of hatred. But qualitatively, what does it mean when we say, no, if you're going to have a partner and you're actually going to do the homosexual act, you can't be a pastor? What have we said? We've said there's something, you know, there's something inherently different about you that is not good. Because we hold the highest standards for our pastors to be examples to others, which has its theological problems as well. Luther said, sin boldly. what's going on there? I think we need to think about this. But quantitatively, I would put us in a very different camp from Jerry Falwell. But what does it mean qualitatively? Qualitatively, to say we will not create a service to recognize bonds of love, and we will not allow pastors to serve who have a same-sex partner.
The difference between us and Jerry Falwell is that we're at least arguing about the issue. It's not a subject for discussion in some of the fundamentalist churches.
That's true, yeah. And so that's a difference, I would say, in the quantity, the difference in the level. But qualitatively, is there a difference?
See, Lars, I think there's just a fear of splitting the church, though. You know, and it's as I have read about it and understand it, it's a vote to keep the church together. It's not anything more than that, as far as I can see. And demographically, time will take care of it, I think. But today, we're electing to stay one body, I think.
I agree that demographically, I think we will take care of this. I got to hurry and get my book out. I think that young people are basically embarrassed that we live in a country that's doing this to people. And plenty of older people are, too. I don't know if you've watched the pictures, but there's a lot of elder people in that picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But on the issue of splitting the church, it is interesting that the first line, almost the first line, of this document that came out for August, puts unity of the church at the very top. And my issue with that as a pastor is I just didn't see that coming up a whole lot in Jesus' ministry. So that's the piece that I struggle with.
Right.
On that.
Right.
Unity of who?
Unity
those who are already in, not those who are on the margins.
Yeah, you talked about keeping the church
that's
together.
Right.
It's
the ELCA church.
The ELCA church at the cost of who will be in and who will be out.
That's true.
Yes.
Paul? I just affirm your sense of college kids. I'm a college teacher, and they are embarrassed that this is an issue. But I'd also, and this is kind of a question and also an observation, I belong to a church with 3,000 members, and I think the people in the church are way ahead of the church's institution. We've discussed this as a church with 300 people there, and when I hear hold the church together, if this one church, this is the typical Lutheran church in Midwest Iowa, I don't think it was for this. I think the people are ahead of the institution.
Thanks. Interestingly, with the Episcopal Church, right, that's been in the news so much with Bishop Gene Robinson's becoming bishop. I stayed at one church of a young rector, a gay person. He worked in Pittsburgh for a year. And Pittsburgh is like, they put thousands of dollars into the anti-gay movement in the Episcopal Church. And then he was able to move over to Levittown, Pennsylvania, near to Philadelphia, in this wonderful little congregation, where he reported, and also the next day, the older Episcopal guy who had been serving since 84 in Philadelphia, both of them said they have heterosexual families in their congregation who are there specifically because they want this kind of an open and welcoming culture for their children to grow up in. They've specifically come there. And that guy in Philadelphia had been there so long that after the kids have grown up and left, the parents come back and say, you know, this was one of the great blessings in my life to have my children grow up in this environment. But both of those pastors, their sense was that this is absolutely not going to split the church. One of them serves on the national board. He says, this is over. Not over, but the press, again. And is he right or wrong? I don't know. But that's his sense as a true insider to this issue, that it's not going to split the church. You have your hand up.
I think historically, unity is the most traditional mask for prejudice.
Yeah. That's pretty concise.
I think the church is
split
over more minute issues than this before, historically. I mean, focusing on differences. And I wonder how unique the church really is if we tell people, no, you're not allowed to be in a loving, affirming relationship because the way you think, the way you are attracted to others is different from us, and that's not okay. And I don't, it doesn't feel unified. I'm outside the ELCA, but went to a Lutheran college, and it doesn't feel unified to look at certain groups of people or say that this isn't an appropriate lifestyle, whereas there are many heterosexual couples living very inappropriate lifestyles and still going to church every Sunday, still receiving communion, still married. They're in terrible relationships. They have children. I mean, I think keeping the church together, it may be overrated if this is an issue that was
split. You know, just a second, but Danielle and Sarah that you saw earlier in there with their family, and I was there for two nights, and we talked about this, and they were great, they're advocates and working hard. She said, but you know, I want you to know that being lesbian is really one of the least interesting parts of my life. The extraordinary normalcy of life, whether we're heterosexual, LGBT, or whatever. I found that over and over again. And by the end, when I met Sarah there, this transgender person in Charlottesville, she was wonderful. So it was kind of like, okay, we got to figure this out, you know? What's your story? We did that. And because that was this ride, it was so easy to talk about. You know, what's your experience as a transgender? And then we got to all this interesting stuff about canoeing and bicycling. And she got up at 5 the next morning so she could bicycle with me out. As a human being, another person. It was so nice in this ride to be spending time with people dealing with an issue. And then you saw in some of those, I stayed in homes where it was heterosexual families, you know, and talking in the same exact kind of manner. Hey, Seth?
I think this whole keeping unity in the church is really just a euphemism for avoiding confrontation of any kind and maintaining the status quo at all costs. And that's really what it means when they say maintain unity.
Yeah.
It's also about not losing face. Because you'd have to say that, oh, we had this policy and we were wrong.
Yeah.
We weren't following the gospel when we had this policy.
Mm-hmm.
But we've said it about other things.
Yeah.
Did we ever count pastors out that got divorced? We gave, we frowned a lot, but I don't think we actually drummed them out.
Yes.
But gee, we gave it up. I mean, we admitted that was a mistake.
Yeah, and a lot of times these things just take decades.
This young intern from Michigan State University said, this is the fastest moving social movement in the history of the country. It's only 52 years old.
In Fargo, we have a woman who was raised Catholic, turned Lutheran, was a divorcee, and now she's our pastor.
Mm-hmm.
So we've come whatever circle that is.
Yeah.
And I think this will pass too, but it's a big time.
Yeah.
Mary?
I think when we talk about like quality and quantity, there's judging, and whenever we judge those who judge, we're down on their level. I think to love them, then we come from another level, and then they sense that love rather than them being judged back. That's a challenge.
Yeah, you know, in terms of what you're saying, what I found was that on this ride, when I approached as a vulnerable person on a unicycle, for people that, you know, hadn't thought about it, were automatically judgmental, when we got talking, we were able to have a good discussion. But to get beyond that is a tricky thing. But to let it go and just say, love, without also pushing on this and realizing how many stories of suicidal plots or friends who committed suicide that I met along this trip, that this truly is a life and death issue. That it's not just about what's going to make a cozy church. This is about life and death. That in Thomas Road Baptist Church, when I sat there with those thousands of people and looked around and knew the significant number of those people in there were gay, lesbian, bisexual, possibly transgendered, but probably not. that would be a giveaway, expelled. Or if they weren't themselves, they were family members of. Sitting in an environment of really toxic hatred, and then having to deal with that. And the stories I heard of people that grew up in those kinds of environments, and how they would be kneeling and falling asleep when they prayed to get rid of being gay. Night after night after night. Trying all these different things, ex-gay movements and all those kinds of things. And the person I heard that story from finally saying, you know, this is who I am. This is how God made me. I celebrate that. And who still can't bring his partner after 10 years home, his parents. You know, so yes, love. And what does it mean to face this as a life and death issue? That's kind of like, how do we put those together? I don't want to let go of the fact that the suicide rate is something like maybe 3 times the national norm. Okay? Joshua?
I just want to, I agree with some of the critiques about the unity issue, but I just want to nuance that a little bit and provide a little tension. I think that there is a sense in which people realize that there are people with faithful perspectives that have not come to the same understanding that those of us of more liberal lines have. And there is a sense that they are Christians too, and they are on a faithful journey as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to put that out there so that we can keep that intention. And I'm not suggesting that for the sake of unity we should dismiss our obligations to social justice. I just want to keep that intention.
About that tension, I don't know a lot of GLBT people who are in the ELCA who's saying they need to leave the ELCA. I hear a lot of people who are angry with the, even considering doing this, saying we're going to leave. And the difference there is that's self-exclusion from the church, where I and my partner, who used to be a pastor, are being excluded by the system. And having served 6 years on the ELCA Church Council and having very, very close relationships to all those people who voted back in April, it didn't make any difference once the institutional frame came down. Fear took over, and they voted to not do the pushing edge thing, to not go for. I've stated what they've done is presented a codifying an injustice. That's what they're presenting at the assembly. And that's with the relationships and everything. That's Mark Hansen, who personally believes this shouldn't be that way, but he's not standing up like the UCC, because I think the bishop is.
Lars, will there be an additional opportunity in the next day or two that some one or the others could talk to you for a little while?
Sure.
About some other.
Yeah.
When do you have to leave?
I leave on Sunday, so tomorrow's fine. Maybe in the morning or something.
I can catch you sometime tomorrow. I have a couple of things
yeah.
I can show you.
Before. That would be really good. I don't know what time do things start down here. 9:45 or?
Oh.
I mean, is there a time we could just meet here? Tell you what, I'll be at breakfast at 8:00 tomorrow. Right, 8:00. And you had a comment?
Let's see. A little while ago. When we were talking about whether we're the idea is unification of the church, I guess after these 15 years, what I would say is, what's left of the church is going a little bit farther and farther right, and the reason is there are so many people who've already been pushed out, and I that's I just think that's what happens when you. When you don't stand up for something like this, that is social justice, and is what we profess that Jesus says, when we can't stand up to it, what happens is the people that are really going to delve into it and say, I have to stand up for human rights and social justice, if they hit a brick wall, they're going to go. And I know very many of them. Many have not gone quietly, but many have. And I think, unity is who's left. Who's left?
You mentioned something coming up in August.
Right. That's the national gathering of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America that will be making decisions about a 5-year study that's been done on whether or not to ordain gay pastors and lesbian pastors as partners, and whether or not to create ceremonies for blessing same-sex unions. We need to go, but I want to close by letting you know that a number of people have told me, and Sarah and Danielle, okay, she was married to a man, and when he started running around town, they split up. She said, I'm not going to have that as a marriage. And then she fell in love with Danielle, okay? All during this time, before and after, okay? Married to a man, now married to Danielle. Legally married to Danielle. She has been an advocate for GLBT justice. And she wrote me often on this trip, and you could just feel the frustration and the anger. She said, when I advocated as the wife of my husband, people listened to me. I had a voice. But now, when Danielle is my partner, and I speak out for GLBT justice, I'm just talking about special rights for myself. I'm just talking about personal things that I want. She feels utterly discounted. And this is a person, if you can hear this experience, if you can really hear this story, who spoke as an insider in the heterosexual community about justice. And now, as a member of the lesbian community, everybody says, oh,
You're just talking out of selfish interest. So I close with this. One, I had a ball on that ride. Some people would say, oh, thank you for going out and doing that as if it was some, well, I hope it serves some use, but I had a ball. I would suggest that to live as an ally on this or anything, an ally for justice, can be one of the most satisfying things we'll ever do. It's consistent with the gospel that we believe in, and it makes a life and death difference for people. The Jubilees issues of yesterday, LGBT right now, all of the different kinds of things we talk about, they make a difference. In the LGBT community, it's called, can you pass, right? Can I pass as a member of the majority community? I am a member of that community. I've always been able to pass. Always been able to pass. I have never had to pick up any of these things. But I tell you, how I have hundreds of emails by LGBT people who have written to me that I will never meet from all across the country and out of this country, France and other places, who have said, thank you for doing this ride. I've had a partner for 30 years. I've had a partner for 40 years. And what you are doing is going to make such a difference. I have no idea if it'll make a difference, and that's really not anything that I have any control over. But I can tell you that every time you stand up as an ally for anything that means justice for the outsider, there will be people that you will hear from and people you won't. But you will save lives you don't even know. I mean, I've been a pastor for a while, I've been involved with this, and I've had people come back and tell me, you know, you helped to save my life. You were one little safe space in a place that otherwise didn't have any safety. It's not about me being a pastor. It's something each and every one of us can do. So that's the end. Thank you so much.